Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So this month, as you're probably aware, is the month of Vaisakh, when we celebrate the birth, enlightenment and parinibbana, passing away of Lord Buddha. And tonight I'd like to talk about one of the epithets or names that the Buddha himself used to describe himself. And that is the name, the Tathagata. And I don't want to go into any great discussion on the Pali, but just to get a sense of what this means in terms of how it affects us. Because the translation that's usually given for the Tathagata is the English rendering of the Pali phrase, the thus gone one. And that doesn't mean much to us. We can't make much sense out of that. And so what I would like to transliterate it to an English equivalent that means something to us is, he did it. And by that I mean he found the way out of suffering, to complete peace and happiness, to enlightenment. And it's actually quite a powerful rendering if we think of how excited we get when we see that someone's done it, whatever it is that we think is really great, whether they've managed to run faster than anyone else has ever run, or climb a mountain that no one else has climbed, or any of the feats that we think are really great, that we get really excited about, or even if we've accomplished something, we've done it, we've succeeded, we've managed to do what's necessary to accomplish the task. And that is the rendering really of the Tathagata that I think means something to us, particularly as we contemplate this aspect of the Buddha as the one who shows us the way. That the Buddha did it for himself, solved his problems, but we have to solve our own problems. We have to do it ourselves. And fortunately for us, because the Buddha left us this wonderful teaching, we have the instructions that we can follow to accomplish what he accomplished. But it's very powerful just to contemplate that without those instructions, we would still be so lost. Because even though we have the instructions, and even though we have the example of not only the Buddha but many others who followed these instructions before us, we still haven't done it. We do need the teacher to show us the way, to keep pointing us in the right direction, because it's so difficult for us, even with the help, to see what the Buddha saw, to experience what the Buddha experienced. Still, we haven't done it. And so one of the things that we contemplate on this Vaisakh time is just how fortunate we are that we have the Buddha as our teacher, and that it's only because of his arising in the world that all of this is possible here today, what we're doing here today, what we've been able to accomplish so far in our practice. And the Buddha wasn't discovering something that isn't available, that wasn't available before he was born. The truth which he's pointing out was there, but we couldn't, if we were there, we didn't see it. Beings up until that time weren't able to see it. It's not something that he invented. He is just simply showing us something, a reality, reality that is here right in this moment. But it still eludes us. We still haven't seen what he saw. We still haven't understood what he understood. And this being able to look outside the box, look outside our own conditioning, is what we can really appreciate that the Buddha provides us with, that guidance. I'd just like to give you an example of how hard it is to see something unless someone shows it to us, unless we learn it from someone else. We know this with children growing up. They have to be shown how to do things, what things are. They have to be guided. But it's very hard to find that chink in the wall unless someone shows us. So there's a story that I usually use in another context, which is about someone who dies and goes to heaven, or so they think. And they think it's heaven because this shining being escorts them into this huge banquet hall. And they think, wow, I've done better than I thought I was going to do. I've made it. Here I am in heaven. And so they walk into the banquet hall, and sure enough, the tables are laden with food, and they're invited to take a seat at the table. And just as they sit down, someone comes from behind them and puts a splint on their arm so that they can't bend their elbow. And when they sit down, they sit at this table laden with food. But when they stretch out their arm to take the food, they can't bend their arm to get the food into their mouth. And it's so frustrating, and they try any way they can to make the food reach their mouth. They bend their head back as far as it will go. They try to throw it from the wrist, the end of their arm, into their mouth. And I've actually done this as an exercise with children, and that's the first thing they try, is try and throw it up and catch it as it comes down. It's very difficult to do. And even if we ask the adults there, is there another way of accomplishing it? Everyone tries to think, how can we do it? We can throw it up higher, or we can move faster, or it just seems impossible. And as this person looks around the room to see how he can learn the trick, he sees that everyone is in the same situation, moaning and groaning because this wonderful food is on the table and they can't get it into their mouth. And he suddenly realizes, this can't be heaven. This is more like hell. And looks around at the shining being, and the shining being says, come with me. And as he walks away, the splints fall off his arm, and he thinks, wow, now I'm really going to heaven. He's escorted into another banquet hall, and same thing, the tables are laden with food. Ah, it's wonderful. This is really it. And just as he goes to sit down at the table again, someone comes up behind him and puts splints on his arms. And again, he can't bend his elbows. That sinking feeling, the same thing, what's going to happen? Again, tries, can get the food, can touch the food, can reach it, but can't get it into his mouth. And then he notices, well, there's no screaming or groaning here. And he starts to look around. First he was just absorbed in the food in front of himself. But then he looks around and he sees something amazing. Everyone is being fed. But instead of trying to put the food into their own mouth, everyone is feeding the person sitting next to them, taking the food, extending their arm and feeding the person sitting next to them. and that's how everyone is getting fed. Now, usually I tell this story to show how important it is that we learn to cooperate and how wonderful it is when we can think not just for ourselves, but we can think how we're going to work together with others so that all of us can get our needs met. But when I was telling this story recently, it struck me again how important it was that he went into another room where there were people who showed him what to do. They showed him by example. Instead of just doing it, trying to get the food in your own mouth, there's an alternative. Look outside the box. Look outside your self-centered view of things. Now, when I first read that story, I couldn't think of how the person was going to get fed. It wasn't until I read the punchline that they were feeding each other that it struck me, well, of course, it's obvious. That would be sensible. But without having the example, very hard to think that one up on our own. And that's why it's so important to have the teacher, why it's so important to have the Buddha, because what the Buddha points out is obvious once we have it pointed out to us. He pointed out the fact, for example, that everything that comes into being is impermanent. It's only temporary. It arises, stays for a while, and passes away. We've heard that so often, and we think, well, yeah, I know that, but we still don't really know it. But now it's a bit more obvious to us than it was previously. The Buddha points out that this body, which we take to be me, which we take to be mine, which we take to be something that I control, I can do with as I like, it's not the truth. We know that this body is actually just a manifestation of nature. We're borrowing it from nature. It follows its own laws, not our wishes, not our hopes. We can't make it stop at age 25 while we're still looking pretty spunky and say, this is good enough, I'll keep this for the rest of the time I'm here, while we've still got the energy that we enjoy to get things done. We can't do it, even though we say, well, this is me, this is mine. It's not really. And it's so obvious. But how we fight against it, we resist it, we refuse to see it. We refuse to acknowledge it. And so we need the teacher to point these things out and to show us how we can start to approach these things and understand them at a deeper level, not just to be smarty pants, but so we can start to live our life in accordance with truth, not in accordance with delusion. The ignorance that the Buddha talked about wasn't the fact that we're not smart, we're not educated, we don't know how to do things. The ignorance that the Buddha talked about was the fact that we still resist acknowledging these truths and these realities. We still get surprised when we hear that someone has died because we just don't like to think about death. And yet death is obviously something that comes with being born for all of us. Now, the reason why we contemplate that and get used to it and understand it as a fact is so that we can make best use of the time we've got now. Realize how precious this life is. How important the people are that we're with right now, because we don't know when we're not going to be together again. That's why we start to really become familiar with this idea of impermanence. The fact that this body is only borrowed temporarily. It's not just to be miserable, it's to wake up so that we make the most of what we've got right now. The Buddha gave a teaching, in fact, when he said, when the Tathagata arises in the world, that is someone who has done it and who's able to show others how they can do it too, it's actually wonderful and marvelous that there are some people who are interested to take up the teaching, because this teaching goes so much against the normal way of the world. Even though it's reality, and even though it's the truth, it goes against how we would like the world to be, where we look to find our happiness and our delight. And the Buddha said it's actually wonderful and marvelous that there are some people who are interested not only in the teaching but interested in the path of practice. And just recollecting that the Buddha's giving this teaching 2,600 years ago, he says, this world delights in excitement, is caught up in excitement. People pursue excitement. And we think that was just today. We just think it's a modern disease, if you like, that everyone wants to move faster, wants to go more places, wants to do more things, wants everything to happen in a more rapid rate, with more intensity. We want to have bigger things, better things. But no, even in the time of the Buddha, he said, people are caught up in that, chasing after the next big thing. And this is one of the things that we can notice in our own experience, this constant looking to the future, not what we've got right now, not how it is right now, but what we're going to get after, how it's going to be better later on, how we're going to get another one, more. Whatever it is, the future is going to be where we're really going to be satisfied. The present isn't good enough. That's what excitement is all about. The next big thing. And the Buddha said, it's wonderful that when people have all that going on around them, so much happening in their life, that when they hear a teaching from the Buddha that centers on peacefulness, stillness, contentedness, that they're actually interested to hear about it and to try to practice for it, to realize it. Now, in the meditation that we've just done, the encouragement is to come into the present moment, to be at home in the present moment, to use the breath to help us to stay focused in the present moment. And I'm sure you will have noticed how the tendency of the mind, the push of the mind, is to move away from right here, right now, to move into the future, to move into the next thing, to look for something more, something bigger, something brighter, something better. This moment is not enough. The breath is not enough. There has to be movement, there has to be action in order for there to be a sense of something happening. And it's not until we're able to stop and be still long enough that we're able to discover that there is a fullness in this present moment, a fullness that doesn't depend on getting something extra, moving somewhere else, filling this space with another thing. There actually is an enjoyment in stillness, a fullness in stillness, in paying attention to just the breath, just this moment. But unless we give the time and effort to that experience, we won't be able to uncover that happiness, that ease, that is already in the mind, We don't have to go anywhere else or do anything else to find it. We just have to be still. It's not just finding a pleasant feeling or being still. Once we start to look more deeply, we can also see what we don't usually see, what we're not able to see. The mind isn't strong enough or clear enough to be able to see. Before the stillness happens, when we start to pay attention to what's going on in our mind, we notice how twitchy it is, how hard it is to get it to stop. We notice what fills up our mind, whether it's worry, whether it's planning, whether it's remembering, whether it's misery, whether it's enjoyment. We start to notice the quality of our own mind, which has never been something that we've paid much attention to in the normal course of things. But it's what we have with us throughout the course of our day, no matter what else is happening. And if we aren't aware of the quality of our mind, then one of the things that we can experience, but which we may never notice, is that if we're miserable, it doesn't matter how many exciting things we do, we'll taste it with a miserable mind. We'll do it with a miserable mind. Whatever we're going to get that's going to make us fulfilled is going to be experienced through a miserable mind. And it may not be just miserable. It may be a mind which is constantly moving off before we've even finished this experience. And so we never get to fully be there, even when it's pleasant. Even when we accomplish what we set out to accomplish, we never fully enjoy it. We never really get out of it what it has the potential to provide us with, because we've already moved off. There's this inherent sort of speediness which doesn't allow us to enjoy what could be enjoyable. So unless we stop in the meditation and look deeply, we don't start to see this. We don't start to see the nature of our own mind, which we're taking with us through every moment of our day. This is why we practice meditation, not only to soothe the mind, but to start to understand ourselves, to see why it is, for example, that we may never feel that it's good enough, or that why we may feel at the end of the day really exhausted because we've never stopped long enough anywhere to put our feet on the ground, to really come home to ourselves. And that's what the meditation is helping us to do, to come home to ourselves. And unless we've got the teacher pointing these things out to us, have a look at this. We don't see it. We're blind to it. It's so familiar to us in one way that we don't see it. And when we're trying to find the source of our misery or the source of our potential happiness, we overlook what is right in front of our face, what is right in front of our eyes, because it seems to be just the way it is. That's the way I am. We don't realize that we actually have a choice, that we can train the mind to be still, to be at ease with itself, to feel content with this moment, to find satisfaction. One of the analogies that I've been giving for meditation is that meditation is like the insulin that a diabetic takes. For a diabetic, insulin doesn't cure their disease, but it allows their condition to stabilize so that they can live a more healthy life. They can do things that they wouldn't be able to do if their diabetes was out of control. They need to take their insulin regularly. They can't afford to let it go. And meditation is like that. It doesn't cure the illness of birth and death, but it allows the mind to stabilize so that we can start to live a life that's more balanced, more skillful, that is more profitable in terms of giving us the happiness that we seek. Meditation allows us to go deeper and to see what we can't see otherwise. And then through practice gives us the ability to start to control the way the mind moves, where the mind goes. Now, just as the diabetic, when they take their insulin, has to work out how much insulin they need according to other factors. So with meditation, meditation is affected by other factors. So in this analogy with the diabetic, the insulin that they need to take will depend on how healthy they are apart from their diabetes, what other conditions they might be dealing with. And so with the meditation, it depends on what kind of mind we have as a result of what kind of life we've lived, what kind of ups and downs we've experienced, what's going on in our life right now, whether we're in a phase of good fortune or we're in a phase of real challenge, that will affect our meditation. And this is one of the insights that we have about the nature of the mind, that this mind, which I think of as me, I'm thinking my thoughts, I'm doing my thing, actually this mind is influenced by causes and conditions, what's going on around us, what our usual way of doing things is, what are the things that usually stir us up, or what are the things that really make us happy. These things will affect the mind, and we start to see this through our meditation. We understand that our mind is constantly in this flux and flow of change. It too is impermanent. It too doesn't belong to me. I can't just make it do what I want it to do through willpower, through wanting. And that's what we experience when we try to keep our attention on the breath in this moment and the mind wanders away. It doesn't follow our commands. But with training, we can actually bring it more and more under our control. Just like the diabetic with their insulin, the amount of insulin will be affected by other factors in their health. Insulin alone will not be enough. The diabetic will have to look at their diet. They'll have to look at making sure they get enough good food, the sort of food that makes them healthy or supports the body. And they'll have to stop eating the things that they know make them sick. And it will be different for every person. What sorts of food are good for one person won't be the same for another. The quantities that they can eat will depend on their state of health, the size, what sort of work they're engaged in, whether they're doing something very energetic, whether they live a very sedentary life, all of those things. But they will need to look at their diet. And so it is with the person who wants to develop their mind in meditation. They have to look at the way that they live their life outside meditation time. And this is why in the Buddha's instructions, he gives the instruction on cultivating virtue and living a good life. Not only learning to restrain our selfish, self-centered impulses, but actively cultivating things which take us outside those selfish impulses. So practicing generosity, being of service, not just in a material way, but in giving our time and energy when it's needed, where we can, in ways that help others without expecting anything in return. Not only being harmless as much as possible, but also looking for ways to express compassion and caring. This is what's called the good food that helps to make the mind healthy. And one of the things that the diabetic has to do is to exercise. And in terms of this analogy, for the person who wants to strengthen their mind and go deeper in meditation, the sort of exercise they need to do is this going outside their comfort zone, moving away from just doing the easiest thing, the thing that we like to do, the thing that keeps us not being too pressed. So, for example, some of you would be aware that for celebrating the Vesak Day this year, we're going to have a day's meditation here at Dharmaloka. And one of the things that we do on that day is we observe noble silence. Noble silence means we don't speak unless it's absolutely necessary. So there's no idle chatter. There's no social conversation. Everyone is encouraged to focus within their own mind and body and to let go of their social persona, so they don't need to be pleasant, put on a show for anyone. They just stay quietly with themselves for the day. Now, for some people, this is a real challenge. It actually is very uncomfortable not to be able to talk. And it takes some people way out of their comfort zone. This is a very simple thing, and if you haven't experienced it, you might say, "Oh, stupid, why would you not want to talk?" Well, one of the reasons for not talking is so that we can observe the inner conversation that goes on endlessly within our own mind, the way that we talk to ourselves, to listen to what we say to ourselves. Very often we're talking about ourselves, and we're talking about others, judging, criticizing, evaluating, comparing. It's not only what we say, but how we say it. When we talk about ourselves, is there always this meanness in our voice? Is it always critical? Or is that the voice that we use when we're talking about other people or things we don't like? In the normal course of our day, we don't really notice those things because we're so busy engaging out there with the world, putting it out there, saying it out there. We don't really notice what goes on before the words tumble out of our mouth. And that is one of the reasons why we engage in noble silence, so that we can listen to the conversation in the mind and we can notice the quality of that conversation. And as I said, this takes us out of our comfort zone, because it's not only what we say, but sometimes what we feel. We just got to get it off our chest. We just got to let them know that. And so when we're silent, what happens with those emotions? What do we do when we have to contain those emotions instead of putting them out? How do we manage that? What does that produce within us? We're starting to notice cause and effect just within our own mind, which we don't normally notice because very often we aren't mindful enough to notice what's going on within us before we've put it out onto someone else. And so deciding to come to a day of meditation practice where we observe noble silence might be really going outside our comfort zone, exercising the mind in a way that it's not used to. But the more that we can do that, the more we expose ourselves to the bigger picture, to an alternative way of looking at things, or to seeing things that we've never seen before. Now, if we don't have the teacher who points these things out or encourages us to try, then we will all try to stay with what we know and what's comfortable, even if it's not really, in the long term, the truth or what's comfortable. So we may not like to look at our mind because it's too uncomfortable. We don't like what we see when we look. And so we distract ourselves. We exit from the situation. We exit from ourselves. We try to go somewhere else that's more pleasant, that's more comfortable. It takes courage. It takes patience. It takes determination to develop the mind in meditation, to be willing to bear with, particularly the early difficulties of sitting with a mind that is undisciplined and not used to staying in one place for long. And until it stays in one place for a while, we won't be able to see below the surface of the mind. We'll always be stuck in just processing what happened to us today and what we're going to do tomorrow. We'll never get beyond that to a depth which reveals more about ourselves than just the ordinary busyness of our lives. Now, if we don't have the inspiration from a teacher, if we don't have the encouragement, we don't have the guidance, it's very easy to lose our way and to give up. And so that's why the Buddha was encouraging us to celebrate the fact that we have got an interest in pursuing this path, and that even in a world of busyness, a world which pursues excitement, that it is full of delusion, that we are interested in listening to the teachings and we are interested in cultivating this path. Even when the diabetic is diagnosed and is given their insulin and it's life-saving, it's a lifelong practice that they have to do. They can't let one day go by without being careful about how they balance their insulin intake, their diet, and their exercise. It's not the end of the problems, if you like. It just is providing some way of coping with them. And that is really what this path of practice provides us with. It's not the end of the problem of birth and death, but it gives us a way of dealing with the dilemmas, the difficulties, the challenges that we face as we go through life. And it gives us the possibility of gradually turning our life into the direction that brings more and more peace, more and more happiness, through greater understanding, through starting to live our life more in accordance with truth. This is actually the promise of the Buddha, that if you practice this path, it will lead you to more and more well-being. So as we celebrate the Buddha's birth, enlightenment and parinibbana, we celebrate the fact that we have this teacher who has shown us the way. And we celebrate the fact that we are walking on this path. And that encourages us to notice when changes do start to happen in our life and to make much of those changes. If we don't notice what we've been able to accomplish, if we don't celebrate them, if we don't rejoice in them, then we may also lose heart, because those changes may be very gradual, they may be very minor, and every now and again we might find ourselves still overwhelmed by the situations we find ourselves in. And this is just to be expected. It's not a sign that we failed in our practice. Just as for the diabetic, there may be other illnesses that they have to deal with, they have to find a balance with. They might have stress coming into their life because of the death of a loved one or something that's happening at work or whatever, and that will require that they have to take major action to bring their insulin intake back into balance, to get the whole of their life back into balance. And it's not that they weren't doing the right things up to that point, it's just that the thing that's come in to their life at this time requires that they meet this challenge anew. And so as we continue to practice this path, don't be surprised that we're going to find times when we seem to be overwhelmed. We seem to lose that stability of the mind. That's just the way it is until we attain the final goal of enlightenment. But if we have kept our eyes open as we've gone along, we will understand this as just par for the course. It's nothing exceptional. And we will also know what we need to do, what strategies we need to bring into place in our life to help us to deal with the challenges that we face now. And one of the most useful strategies is to go and talk to a teacher or go and talk to someone who has walked this path further than we have. They may not be a teacher, a monk or a nun, but they may be just a friend who we know we can trust, we can confide in, who can be a good friend to us and help us in that situation. And it's very important, the Buddha said, to use our friends, to use our teachers, especially at the times when doubt arises. Am I doing it correctly? Is this the right path? What else should I be doing? How come it's not working? Doubt can undermine us when we don't realize that the path will be full of these ups and downs, and that there is always something we can learn, even from the most difficult times that we meet. But very often, we won't know how to look at it to find the lessons to be learned. We won't know where to look at it to see what can be learned from it. And that's why it's so important to have the teacher or the good friend that we can go and speak to. So this brings us back again to the starting point of the Buddha as the one who did it, the one who accomplished the path, the one who shows us the way. If we didn't have that teacher, we wouldn't know how to do it ourselves. But because we have the teacher, because we have the teaching, we have this wonderful asset that is available for us all to call on at any time. So as we celebrate Vesak, I encourage you to celebrate your own practice and rejoice in the fact that you have this wonderful opportunity in this life to practice the Buddha's teachings. May this teaching tonight be of benefit to all of you, and may it help us all to attain Nibbana.
Arahant Sammā Sambuddho Bhagavā Bhūtāṁ Bhagavatam Abhivādini Svāpātto Bhagavatā Dhammo Dhammaṁ Namassāmi Sūpatthipanno Bhagavatam.